Hey there, fourth trimester listeners. Our program today is proudly sponsored by Family Album, your secure haven for sharing baby photos and videos. Head over to the App Store today, search Family Album, one word, download the app, and start creating a legacy of love, one photo at a time. Hi, I'm Sarah Trott, and welcome to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm a new mama, and this podcast is all about postpartum care for the first few months following birth, the time period also known as the fourth trimester. My postpartum doula, Esther Gallagher, is my co-host. She's a mother, grandmother, perinatal educator, birth and postpartum care provider. Fourth trimester care, our topic, is about the practical, emotional, and social support parents and baby require. And importantly, it helps set the tone for the continuing journey of parenting. This is Sarah Trott. Welcome back to the Fourth Trimester Podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Esther Gallagher, and we have a special guest with us today who I'll introduce in a moment. So I want to just remind you that we have a newsletter sign up available on our website, and there are a lot of good resources and recipes and articles you can find on the site as well. And if you're interested in sponsoring the Fourth Trimester Podcast, we would very much value your contributions. And you can go to our website, and there's a link for sponsorship there, or you can go directly to patreon.com to find our sponsorship information. So our guest today is Jane Honickman. She is a Californian born and bred, and she's very much grounded in West Coast mentality. She co-founded the Postpartum Education for Parents called PEP in Santa Barbara, California in 1977. She also founded the Postpartum Support International in 1987, 10 years later, to represent the self-help support groups working to prevent the negative emotional responses to childbearing. In 2015, she co-founded the Postpartum Action Institute, created for individuals who are committed to confronting the stigma of mental illness and the mythology surrounding new parenthood. Her family is her supportive husband, going on 50 years this July. Amazing. Congratulations. And three adult children, their spouses, eight grandchildren, and a cat. That's very impressive. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, Sarah and Esther.
Hi, Jane. I'm just thrilled to have you. I've been telling Sarah about you for a while, and I'm so glad that we got to circle around and do this. You founded Postpartum Education the year I had my daughter.
Oh, very nice.
Who's now 38.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's very, very timely. And today is actually my youngest child's 42nd birthday. So yay, babies.
Happy birthday to you.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It just makes me feel really old and sorry I can't be with her, but she just wanted to sleep in anyway, so who cares?
Yeah. Right. That's the best birthday present, right?
That's
extra
right.
Sleep. Well, Jane, would you be willing to tell us a little bit about your experience of new motherhood?
Sure. So it's a great pleasure to be able to share and put things into perspective for all our listeners. But I want to begin by saying how brilliant your title of your podcast is, because the fourth trimester is like, I remember saying to the obstetrician almost 45 years ago, saying, you know, the hardest part is after the baby is born. You really should call this the fourth trimester. And he said, well, tri means three. So no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling,
yes, you can.
Yes, you can. But all these years later, you know, we're saying, yes, you can. But I remember feeling so deflated. Yeah, but this is really hard. And the irony part of my story is that the precursor to the son born in 1972 was a daughter born in 1966 before we were married, and she was placed for adoption. And so I never got to be the mother I always dreamed I was going to be because I hadn't done it in the right order, which is, of course, you don't have sex before marriage, and of course, you get married before you have a baby. So that really threw the monkey wrench into my long-term plans as a woman, which of course dates me because I grew up, my formative years were during the 50s, and my My role model, of course, was my mother. And without saying any more, that's just a very, very powerful and important person in one's life. And the shame and the embarrassment and all of that is all about secret keeping in those days. And so our firstborn was never discussed. She was raised in another country. And we never saw her until we finally reached out and reconnected with her. And that's another story. But what happened, of course, is that we then did it, quote unquote, right, and got married and then had the graduate degree and the first job and the house. And okay, now let's have a baby. And enters the 1970s. And I was like, wait a minute, this is really tough. And I don't get why I'm now feeling like I'm being punished by the demands. And I was just clueless. It has to all be in the couple terminology of a we. But that was important because I like to emphasize the importance of friendships around this time of transition and normalizing the fact that this is the toughest job in the world. And doesn't matter where and when. Once you've survived your pregnancy and your birth, and then you enter into this next world, there really is nothing that can prepare you because you don't really know what you're receiving on that other end, what kind of child you're going to have, or the circumstances and all the impacts.
And the cultural message to this day is, okay, everything worked out great.
Right.
You've got a baby who's alive in your arms.
Yeah.
Right? Period.
So then you ask, why isn't it wonderful? And a lot of it has to do with expectations, the mythology around this, all this happening. And then, of course, plain old simple exhaustion, isolation. And it's just, you're clueless. I don't care how many times you even have done it. It's always different. And I always like this to coin the phrase, you know, postpartum may be defined by 1 year, but the truth is it's forever and ever because you never change back to being pre-parent. Even with loss, I mean, all of these things that happen, you just can't help yourself. So that was the beginning, and that was in the 70s. And what I did with my girlfriends really was incredible. That was powerful because the organization is all volunteer based. There's no staff. There's no office. It's just all volunteer parents who staff the very first warm line. We came up with this idea of a warm line in the 70s because of the emphasis on child abuse and hotlines and crisis intervention. It's like, wait a minute. We don't want it to go there.
Why do we have to wait that long?
Exactly. And so that's what one of the things I'm most proud of is the fact that my girlfriends and I collaboratively worked, and it's all about self-help. It's all about community-based. It's all about social support. And this is about normal adjustment to parenthood. And that's where I started from.
That's just fantastic. I don't think we can overstress the feelings of existential aloneness
right.
that motherhood can bring, even when we're in what we think is a fairly supportive community.
Exactly.
Now, we may have the dearest of friends, but if we're, for instance, the first of our cohort to have the baby,
yep.
our friends group is clueless.
Yeah. And it's about walking in the walk and then not comparing yourself too much because everybody's walk is different. And then it's not just you. You are a couple. There's partners involved. And then, of course, you're surrounded by your heritage, your culture, and your DNA. And people just in general were just like, oh, it doesn't matter where I came from. It's going to be fine moving forward. Well, it does matter very, very much. And people ignore that we actually being given a gift to understand ourselves better if we understood our own family's past. Mm-hmm. Whatever it may be.
My family is primarily Irish, and there are areas of Ireland that have some of the highest rates of depression in the world, not just, you know, in Ireland or Europe or in the world. My grandmother never talked about depression. She had 6 kids. My mother went back east to have me and was subjected to twilight sleep and then had probably what was a short-lived psychotic break. my mom had gorgeous pregnancies, easy pregnancies, easy births, and then got pregnant rapidly. There are 4 kids in 5 years.
Oh.
And then at baby 5, went into a downhill spiral. I think the only thing protecting her from postpartum depression was pregnancy for those years. Well, I didn't have that protection. I didn't get pregnant right away and didn't have conversations with my family about or knew to talk about depression. I think my dad also has depression. So, you know, just the history of depression,
right,
unlinked from childbearing would have been handy.
Yeah, it's critical. People need to understand that. Number one is your DNA and vulnerability to other diseases as well. But what we know now about mental illness is that the very first thing we look into is our past and then our personal. So it's family history and personal history. Well, thank you for sharing that. So there's 3 things I want everybody to hear. There's one is plain ignorance because people don't know something. And then denial that maybe what you've learned, it's not applicable to you and it doesn't matter what you just heard or learned. And then the power of just not talking. And when you have depression, the gene shuts you down. And so people just say, well, just speak up and talk about it and let me know how you're feeling. It's like, well, you don't quite understand. You're not capable. It's a very powerful, sad thing. And then the family history for me was that, and again, I was raised in the 50s and we certainly didn't talk about mental illness. And my father was bipolar. And I was just kept, you know, happy little girl, and I didn't ever understand, and they were always protected me from why daddy went away and why he was acting in kind of strange ways. But you know, it came and went, and you just didn't deal. I mean, on the other hand, you did deal by ignoring it, and that's back to denial and ignorance. So then when I got pregnant unexpectedly and then kept that secret, these things are traumas, and people forget how even this, okay, I'm better now, I can move on. The truth is the brain never forgets anything. It's buried, but it does come back to you. And that's why talk therapy is so important. It's why medication works, because the brain is ripe for, you know, being hurt and scarred and then healed again and then moving on. But we do tend to ignore that. And then culture, I mean, it definitely is about trying to please other people, making sure you do it quote unquote right, and it need to be correct, and you need to be wonderful, and you need to do it all by yourself. So that was the biggest problem, is isolation. The cultural piece for me and my generation was that we moved away from family. And we did not have anybody to surround us with any kind of cushion, but friendship. And then the friendship is like, okay, but how do I accept that? And I think that's another big missing piece of this, is that learning to accept that this is difficult, you need help, you can't do it alone. Has that changed at all?
I would like to say it has, but I know that for the most part in America, I think probably the overwhelming majority of women are still experiencing similar circumstance.
I would say there might be slightly less pressure to do things quote unquote correctly or the right way. Mm-hmm. I think that some of that 1950s, 60s mentality has dissipated, but that's not true for all parts of the United States or all cross sections of the culture.
Yeah. And I think when we live on the West Coast, as Jane sort of alluded to earlier, that we have the opportunity to be unusually well-resourced. But I have to say, growing up in rural California, I don't know that things have radically changed. They have changed for the better. My mom was lucky enough to have recourse to something called family services way back in the day, which was access to psychotherapy for low-income people. And she says to this day, it saved her life.
Good.
I think mostly the way it saved her was it turned her in the direction of her intellect, going back to school to cultivate a, you know, her intellect and a career. It was very feminist in that sense.
That's right. I want to pick up on that because my generation in the United States was definitely, we were the second wave feminists, and we were just determined to change everything. And we really have changed everything. And, you know, speaking to the young women and couples who are listening to this is that you have no idea how hard we work to make things so much better than they are, than they were. I think that's underappreciated. And then on the other hand, as a feminist and as a woman who is determined to sort of take back my body and take back our life and move on and do all this social action and be agents of change, all these great things that we successfully have done, I think that one of the mistakes we've made as women is to leave out the men. And my husband was one of the first of the Lamaze movement that allowed the men even into the delivery room. And this is the 70s in California. And it was such a big deal. And then the second, you know, 3 years later, we were allowed to tape record. And so it's exactly 42 years ago today that we tape recorded the birth of our daughter. And I mean, I remember saying it, I don't remember saying it, but it's on a recording. Is she the right color? And it turned out she wasn't, and she was very jaundiced. And that was another example of a, you don't know what you're going to get. And this, this baby had severe jaundice, and we, you know, had all sorts of trauma around that. And then in terms of my own past trauma, here's my little girl, I'm replacing the little girl I had to give away through adoption. And this little girl might die. And then I just spun down because I thought I had, you know, been being punished by God that now I'm going to lose the daughter I gave away. And how, the guilt was just unbelievably difficult. I mean, obviously.
I should imagine it really triggered grief that you had previously had to hide.
And still, I mean, it took me, this is the other piece of my journey is that you think that you can just move on without thinking about the past, and it just doesn't work. And it took me so many more decades to finally get the help I needed. And one of the reasons I got so involved in this field is because it was my therapy. And it was very, very therapeutic to be active and making lives at least a little bit better, being whatever way I could be proactive in assisting families. And again, you know, fourth trimester and onward, that's important.
So much of the grief we carry forward into parenthood seems disconnected, right? And yet it isn't. It's integral.
And for the woman who's having the biological change, and we leave out the man and the sperm, he is equally, it's absolutely equal. Or it could be another woman. I mean, the reality is it could be, you know, all sorts of configurations of family designs. It doesn't matter. It does not happen in a test tube, and it's not alone. You don't raise the child alone. And the bubble children are even not raised alone. There's an outside world. So it's really something we tend to forget. And so whatever baggage or delightful packaging you get from either side, you come together and you look at each other as, oh my gosh, we're now going to raise this child or maybe multiples together. Well, we haven't even talked about how were we raised and do we want to do it the way we were raised or not? And is like, is it ideal? And ooh, where are those people anyway? Are they surrounding us with love and too many casseroles? Or, you know, have they ignored us completely? I mean, it's something we just can't prepare for. And then you don't know how the, of course, now I'm the many generations away and my girlfriends are, we're grandparents. And the first advice you give to about to become a grandchild, I mean, grandparent to their child is to keep your mouth shut. Well, as you have to figure it out yourself. But it sounds like you're criticizing.
Yes.
If you say anything.
I think we could all do to learn some healthy languaging around how to interact with new parents or becoming parents, right?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Sarah, do you remember me talking with you and Ben about how the two of you were sharing a hormonal trajectory and that, you know, Ben was going to also experience the postpartum hormonal shift. Now, how it would manifest for him might be particular to his biochemistry and social emotional whatever, right? But that he indeed would himself be postpartum just the way he was pregnant with you. And I, when I taught childbirth prep classes, I always, as well as the surviving the first 6 weeks classes, they were so-called, used to take families through this, like, this has been studied. It's not just phenomenon, that it's also biological.
It's so biological. And again, this, and it's worldwide. I mean, it's just like, it doesn't matter where you are, what language, what culture, what religion, whatever it is it's the same biology that's taking place. Mm-hmm. And has from the beginning that we know of. Where it's going, I don't know, but pretty much this is primal, basic biology. And again, it's out of our control. And that's the other thing that people love to do is control. There's a power yeah. that's greater than us. So there's an upside about that. There's a theory that those of us who are in this moment and are the result of the people who came before us who did understand their adrenal cortex enough to run away from that lion that was coming at us.
Yes.
And so learning about our reaction to fear and responding in an appropriate way is what we have inherited. Sometimes mm-hmm. we think it's all depression and anxiety and it's all this mental illness is a bad, you know, a thing. And we've inherited this evilness feeling. But it's in fact, we are descendants of those who actually are survivors because they knew how to get out of the way of harm or luck too, a lot of luck. But we are who we've evolved to. But you have to know how you are, and we don't. I mean, unless you're really intuitive and also, or been lucky enough to have been in therapy, because if you've already gone down some of this road, you may have already tuned into that. Oh, that explains why I used to, you know, get stomach aches or, oh, my headaches, they mm-hmm. all just came from that. And like, I'm talking about me. I had no clue that that was all indicative of the fact that I had inherited this depression gene, which I did pass on. To my daughters, both of them have had bouts of reoccurring depression. Luckily, not around pregnancy or birth. That was the one thing that we were able to help because of, I think, my openness and the examples of what I established and learned and passed around. And then I learned how to be supportive. And also their spouses were incredibly wonderful. And as wonderful as my husband tried to be, we were like so dumb and so clueless. And there was the blind leading the blind is like, what's this baby doing? We had no idea. But the next generation, our son and our daughters and their experiences with having their babies was just the opposite, you know, and the men yes. are nurturers as well and want to be, and then the expectation is shifted. And I think that yay feminism, what we really did was really bring that to an equal level. And as opposed to my poor husband this generation, we're just like, okay, you got to come in here. You got to see this baby born. You know, you got her pregnant, you know, see her push it out. And then it's like, okay, now you need to learn to diaper and you need to, it's like the guys go, what are you talking about? Yeah. They didn't have fathers who participated. So why would they? They wanted to and they learned. Mm-hmm. But I think mm-hmm. that we really have gotten better at that. It's not perfect, but it's gotten a lot better.
Just allowing men to be nurturers because they want to be. They do want to be, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not fair to say you're going to be workers and soldiers.
No.
There are a lot of women who are listening to our show who are pregnant now, possibly for the first time. And it seems to me that we could paint a number of scenarios of possibilities because there isn't any kind of rule, right?
No. Nope.
Like right. just yeah. because your family had depression doesn't mean you're going to have depression.
No. Nope.
And vice versa.
Particular. Yeah. Right. And someone who's never had that in their family, they could experience that. I'm curious to know more about the concept of your warm line.
Sure.
Because there isn't a phone number that's being flashed on TV. And if there's someone out there who thinks, oh, maybe I would like to have a resource on hand in case after I have my baby, I'm feeling like I could use some support on a practical note, like what would you advise those people?
the most important thing is to figure this out during pregnancy. And the during your pregnancy time, there are three barriers. One's fear, one's decisions, and the changes that are taking place are their challenges during your pregnancy with your partner and your family. Sometimes we just don't talk about that. And generating resources during pregnancy is the critical time, and we all need them. And you don't wait for this. There's just as much depression and anxiety during pregnancy as there is postpartum. So, and for the men, this statistic is holding true, and we can just say conservatively 10%. 1 in 10. So just look around your childbirth class, you know, and understand that this is going to happen to somebody in the room. And even if it's not you, you're the resource for somebody else. So there are some very, very nice, simple, things we can use in terms of self-help and resources within, learning that you're not alone, that you're not to blame, and this is temporary, and with help you'll get well and be fine. Those are really critical things to remember. We call that the universal message.
The fact that it will get better, that all these three things are true, does not mean that it's not important now to address them, right? Please do address them now. That's how they will get better.
That's right. Not,
they'll just go away.
It doesn't just go away. No. And yeah. I think that's, and again, my example for myself is that I waited way too long, as in my 50s, before I got help. So no, you don't do that. So we don't have to do that. But sometimes denial is a very powerful thing, and you're not ready. So it's okay to be able to say, I need to focus on the baby now, and this, that's healthy too. It's just know in the back of your brain at some point. And these things come and go. You may absolutely remember if 10% of people don't do well, you know, how many 90% are fine. So remember that we're there. And that's why the warm line idea came from. If you're having a momentary crisis in the middle of the night and you just want to know that you should call your doctor because the baby hasn't stopped crying, that's an example where if you didn't know to be reassured by somebody else who'd been there, had been sleepless all night long, that you think you're weird or you might push you over the edge. So, you know, this is back to resources, knowing that it is normal to have needs during your pregnancy and postpartum and actually for life that need to be met with non-judging support. And that's emotional support. That's just what we should do for each other, to be in kind, caring, compassionate conversation with people. You know, that empathy, you know, I hear you, and I understand that this is tough. And tell me, how was it last night? Did you sleep? I mean, you're pregnant. You're not sleeping at the end, right? Mm. And then you're caught up with, how am I going to literally get through my labor? What's going to happen? All of these unknowns. Those are hard, and we just need to be able to set. The greatest need for parents is to talk. Mm-hmm. Talking is therapy. And why? Because we know that the biology of the brain needs that oxygen. You inhale and you exhale and you talk about how it felt. And if you can't find somebody to talk to about how your pregnancy is going, how labor went, I think one of the most telling things is, if you still need to talk about your labor, you need to talk about your labor. If you mm-hmm. still need to talk about how hard it was to nurse, or that you decided you know, the expectation of vaginal birth changed to cesarean, you need to talk about that experience. And then again, that's the warm line. The idea that this is normal to be able to sit and talk. Now, in our example in Santa Barbara, where we set up this PEP, and it's sustained itself for 40 years. We're celebrating 40 mm-hmm. years of PEP this year. All volunteers, never a paid staff, no therapy. This is normal stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And the beauty is, we try to match somebody who calls the warm line, who says, I'm having sore nipples, or I'm having no desire to have sex with my husband, or you name it, or mm-hmm. I am... You know, if you pick it, there's a volunteer who has said, I have that special circumstances. I'm happy to talk to somebody else who's going through it now. Mm-hmm. And that's back to the listening and the openness and the caring, and that you won't be judged. because sometimes when we open up to somebody we thought was a friend, but they haven't gone through it, or they did and they got over it, or whatever it is, they don't may not even mean to say it, but they may be interpreted as being judgmental to the person who's in that moment. And then it gets worse, right?
Yeah. I'm thinking of my daughter's dad had what I thought of as at the time as a very selfish and extreme reaction to the baby crying. He would kind of lose his mind. And my only recourse at that time and the way I felt about it was, I can only deal with one crying baby at a time.
Right.
I can only deal with one person who is inconsolable, emotionally speaking, at a time. And I had to tell him at one day when he looked at me in a kind of anxious fury and said, "Can't you do something about that?" I had to say to him, "You know, if you can't deal with this, you need to leave." And basically gave him permission to abandon us, which I don't blame him. Like, he just couldn't tolerate it. And it's too bad. As far as I know, he had nowhere to go with that.
And of course, it's very good example of, we don't know what had traumatized him to set him up for that sensitivity level of, frankly, it's hell having a child that creates, and do we have to tolerate it? And it's so mean, and why is, and so we blame the baby. I mean, you know, and then we blame ourselves. Oh, I didn't, my milk isn't right. And then the man who is not biologically directly connected to having gone through the birth and delivery and such, they're really out in left space, out of space. I mean, they're left out completely. And depression gets you angry. And if people forget that anger is depression. And very often we will lash out. One of the statistics I'm sure still holds true is that more people are divorced in the first year after the birth of a baby than any other time. Because this is so difficult. And you really, and why do we expect it to be easy? I'm not sure. Domestic violence and crimes against women are just astronomically bad. And so we know that then more than women are beaten during their pregnancies. And of course, just think what that impact is on the fetus. And that's why this ongoing violence continues to perpetuate itself, because we haven't dealt with that. But it's really important to, if only we could take one step back and look at this analytically, which you can't when you're in the moment. And my equivalent to the baby not crying was that my baby cried because he was hungry, because I didn't have enough milk. And my husband saying to me, "You're starving our child." And I mean, it's just horrible, but you know, that was a shock to me. And we really didn't have a warm line. We didn't have anything at all. And somehow, there's all sorts of other things that were wrong. The baby had an ingual hernia. He had to have surgery at 4 weeks. I mean, this is the things that tumble out of the vagina, basically. You had no clue that these things are going to be happening. And then things, every time I was pregnant, my husband lost his job. I mean, that's that's not too cool, know. But we persevered and you keep on pushing through. I would want to interject one critical word, and that's communication. You mentioned trying to find the right language, how we speak to each other around this time. It's so imperfect. But I think that understanding how we trigger each other with certain words, and then we're so sleep deprived. And it's a form of torture. And that's why we need doulas and friends and family to
sleep
to help us get that sleep that we don't get. And that goes for everybody.
Hey, fellow parents, can we take a moment to reflect on the joyous chaos that is parenthood? You know those days when our hearts swell with love at the sight of our little ones and we're bursting at the seams to share every adorable moment with the world. But let's be real. Some things are better kept in the family, and your loved ones who matter the most aren't always close by, and they might not be that tech savvy either. So how can you easily share your baby's beautiful growth with loved ones while keeping your precious memory secure? I remember the frustration of trying to use some of the big tech photo solutions, only to find they fell short of what I needed. That's when I stumbled upon something truly remarkable, the Family Album app. The Family Album app was created to give parents a secure and easy way to share photos and videos with loved ones. It's an orderly and totally secure haven for your family's personal memories. I love that there's no third-party ads, no unwanted eyes, unlimited storage, and that it's totally free. So to all the parents who are out there still trying to use other messaging apps for your kids' photos, it's time to level up your family photo game with a free photo sharing app. Head over to the App Store today, search Family Album, one word, download the app, and start creating a legacy of love one photo at a time.
I read a nice passage in a book called Parenting from Within, where a man shared a story about his own experience with trauma associated with crying. So whenever he heard a crying baby, he would get really stressed and upset. And of course, he eventually figured out it was back to something he'd experienced. He thought it was from his own childhood, but it was actually from his experiences working in a child ER. But I like that you brought up this concept of triggers. If your husband or your partner or whoever's helping you gets really stressed and you're not stressed at all, maybe think about what they're reacting to. Are they really reacting to your situation at hand? Maybe not. And that kind of, I think, helps reframe one's own reaction to have compassion for that person and think, wow, they're reacting that way because they probably have some trauma. And
in which case it might just be the question, right? Like, it seems like you're really having a strong reaction. Why do you think that is? Because I'm in the room with the baby. The baby's doing the same thing. I'm not having that reaction. I really want to understand why you might be having this reaction so we can help you with that.
Yeah. And it does take a long time to figure that out and may not be immediate. And that's the other thing about processing. Processing also happens differently. And some people do it quickly and other people do it very, very slowly. And that interferes with communication. And that harkens back to my marriage because we really struggle still about communicating, and that's 50 years of trying, 50 years plus trying. It's a real art, and we don't think alike, whether it's just male and female differences or how we were raised. My husband comes from South Africa, so he had a different cultural experience. And it's also about who did raise us and how close were we to these various other people in our families. Oh, then there's siblings and other things that we throw in there. But it is really so nice if we all communicated well. Again, I see in my children that they communicate so much better with their spouses than I communicate with mine. And one of the best lines, my daughter, who's the one who's having their birthday today, she said to us, we were having an outing, a family vacation, and our daughter turned to us and said, I don't know which is worse, listening to my parents bicker or my children bicker.
Oh, my God. I'm with her 100%.
I think everybody can relate.
I can tolerate about 3 days of either on either side.
Yep.
And it's and then I'm done.
Oh, and we were so embarrassed because, of course, we know we do this, but, you know, we looked at each other and go, oh, no. And my daughter has no memory of having said this. So that's the other funny part is that she said the most important thing and yet didn't realize it came out of her mouth. But it's really true. Well, you know, that's a really insightful and an example from my mom. Came to visit only now and then when I had my children, because she, frankly, as she would say, really not into babies. she liked them when they could talk back and have arguments with her and debate and all that. So anyway, she would visit and she'd come and she said, you know, Jane, I've noticed every time I come to visit, you have difficulty nursing. And it suddenly dawned on me. She was stressing me out because I was trying to be the perfect daughter to show her that I was being a good mother. Like I thought she had been a good mother to me, and she finally picked up on she was stressing me out. And sure enough, I got my breast infections when she came to visit.
Wow.
And I was like, Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But talked about triggering.
Yeah, but I didn't want her to leave. I didn't want her, I wanted her around me.
You wanted your mom.
Well, and I wanted her to be more helpful. That's back to expectations.
Yeah. Well, Jane, why don't you dive into the Postpartum Support International website?
Well, with pleasure. Of course, when I started PSI, it was 10 years after I had helped develop this, what we call System of Action for Families mm-hmm. in Santa Barbara with PEP. And I got mm-hmm. exposed to the, what we call the less than wonderful, the world of psychiatry related to childbearing in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And that led me to going to scientific meetings, trying to understand what are they talking about, psychiatric illness? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just talking about normal adjusting to parenthood. And sure, there's depression, but what? So one thing led to another, and I ended up forming this, first we had a conference and brought people together who were already working in the field. Mostly they're from Canada and England, and that I knew about. And then I realized people around the States needed to get organized too. So it became a clearinghouse out of my own home for 18 years, and this was way before there was internet. I fielded calls from people from all around the world asking for resources in their own community and to try to understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward to the time when we have the internet and can go online and learn so much more, and we can get educated more in a sophisticated way. So if you go to postpartum.net, you pulls up all sorts of things, but I'm very proud to say that PSI is the leader in the area. But it is international, and there's something in every country and every culture, some way, somehow, to find help. And the organization that's not mentioned enough is the scientific group that educated me. It's called the Marseille Society. And the Marseille Society was formed in the 1980. I went to my first in England, and I went to my first meeting in the Oakland Hills, across from San Francisco, 1984. And it was as a result of a journalist who contacted me writing the first book on this topic, and it was called The New Mother Syndrome. It became the classic. It is the classic. And that led me to integrate the science and the clinical and the research stuff that I was clueless about, because remember, I'm coming from the self-help side, and then the practical self-help side, and melding together through the Marseille Society, which meets every other year. I've been on their boards for all these decades and go to all their meetings. We were just in Australia last fall. We'll be in India in 2018, and this is bringing together the best of the best, the people who know the most and the most, and understand the history of all the movement, how far we have come, how far we still have to go. Mm-hmm. But the PSI piece is about social support, and it's the simplest, it's the most cost effective, and it's the most neglected, and it's the biggest gap there is. And yet it's right at our fingertips. So for example, what we have in Santa Barbara is unique. It's still never been replicated anywhere. There are a lot of variations on the theme. There's a lot of wonderful, wonderful work going on around the world, bringing together the science and the practical. But we still have a long ways to go. But PSI mm-hmm. is still the leader. And if people are, wherever you're living and you're listening to this, you need to know your own community's resources. And you shouldn't have to call long distance. You shouldn't have to go onto internet. You should be able to ask your own professionals, the caregivers in your lives, your families, how do I prepare for this big change that's going on in my life? And knowing that I may be susceptible to depression and anxiety, what's going to be there for me? Mm-hmm. Do that. And then again, it can be in any culture. But with PSI, it certainly helps. And the language is correct on the website with PSI. That's mm-hmm. why I'd say go to that first. The caution I have for everybody is don't read too much. And, surround yourself with what makes sense for you and your family. You know, an area that we neglect to include is our faith community. It's the largest community for most of us around the world. And we need to know who surrounds us in that spiritual sense. Some people feel it more than others, but it's good resources if it's non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. And that's the critical piece. And if you feel comfortable, a lot of people, remember, 90% of the world's population just gets on with it. And this is normal stuff, but it's tough stuff. And no matter what, you want to know that you're not alone if your child has colic, if your baby it has a learning disability, if you have had, you know, a car accident and something happens. You know, these things can happen. Our lives get turned upside down on a dime. In a split second, things can change. And so you have to know who's surrounding you. It's that sense of security around yourself and your family and surrounding yourself with people. Again, critical words, non-judging people who are going to love you unconditionally and you can communicate well with.
The word postpartum for a lot of people just means depression.
Yes, I'm going to take responsibility for that. I own it. Same. And I really, it's very upsetting because everybody needs to know that when we pick the word postpartum education for parents, those three words for our organization in the 70s, we use the word postpartum as the adjective that describes having given birth the year after delivery through adoption or otherwise. And that's all it is. It's an adjective. Mm-hmm. It's descriptive. And the other piece of that is that it worries me that we still have people saying, but I'm not postpartum. They're holding their baby and they say, I'm not postpartum. And that what they mean to say is, I'm not depressed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the fact that they're we're having to say it, you know, I'm proud that we're at least talking about it, but I'm embarrassed mm-hmm. the fact that it's been misconstrued. And I would give anything if we could correct our language. In the rest of the world, they were saying postnatal before we coined postpartum for our organization. And that's why we really wanted to say after birth.
Yeah.
But that sounded like the word placenta. So we didn't want to use that. And so,
so complicated.
It is complicated. And it's, and that brings up the point of language again and how to communicate exactly what's going on. And so that's
And I think that there's a simple intervention, and that's just that those of us who understand the distinction can simply address it whenever it comes up.
Yeah. And the other is, why am I
and
still
you add on the term depression, if it's applicable.
Right.
And when you use the word postpartum, you're simply referencing that you had a baby.
Exactly. And then, the other thing is in the clinical world, if you're not feeling like yourself, the first thing that needs to be ascertained is, when did it start? Mm-hmm. Because if I have a 3-year-old, I'm still not feeling myself. It's one of the most important tease away the layers here. So when did you start feeling? So they said, actually, I when I was pregnant, I really noticed a change in myself, and I haven't been the same since. Okay, mm-hmm. Or it could have been the baby had to go be hospitalized, and that would turn me on. You know, it just needs to be explained, and I think that's really back to language and helping us figure that out.
And just because there isn't a depression element doesn't mean someone doesn't need support either.
Well, yeah. I can't emphasize that enough. I mean,
good one, Sarah. You're absolutely right. Of course. And why don't you talk to us a little bit about what staying resourced through this first year has meant for you and Ben?
The big difference for me was being able to anticipate things before they happened, which made me feel reassured and secure. And the reassurance that what I was doing was fine. I think because there's a lot of self-doubt as a first-time parent. Oh, am I doing this the right way? Am I doing that the wrong way? I mean, just stuff as simple as, what should I expect with my baby sleeping? Is it okay that she's sleeping next to me in my bed? Is it okay that she's, just everything.
How much is she peeing and poop, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sarah, and let's remind our listeners and Jane that when you met me prenatally, you were looking for a birth doula.
Yeah, that was it. I didn't know what a postpartum doula was. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people still don't. Right. I think they think postpartum means depression and doula just is not necessary because you're going to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And the people who care for us after the baby is born is, of course, us, the mother, by ourselves, being pioneer women, toughing it out, you know, just there's so many images out there, especially on Instagram. You know, there's body stuff. There are all kinds of expectations that I think are really unfair and misinforming. And I love that, you know, here we are in 2017. We just in January, end of January, experienced the largest global women's march in the world. And the main message there is about defense, defending feminism, defending equality, defending the rights that we've gained so far, because
defending reproductive rights, which we mm-hmm. talked about with Kimberly Seals-Allers. You know, breastfeeding is a reproductive right, and we don't even talk about it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think just going back to your question, like being supported was something that I stumbled upon. I was looking for someone to assist me in my birth scenario because I knew that I wanted someone in addition to my husband present. So hiring a professional was a good answer for me. And thank goodness I did, because it changed my entire postpartum experience. There's a deep desire to be taken care of as a new mom. There just is. It's there. And maybe we would admit it, or maybe we are in denial.
Or feel shame.
Would say, or feel shame, like, oh, no, I should be able to do this. But actually, if you admit to yourself, if you're vulnerable enough to go ahead and say, you know, I would really love someone to nurture me and take care of me. It may not be your mom, but you kind of need that mommy love as an adult. You've just done something so hard and miraculous, and you have so many needs, physical and emotional and practical, all at the same time, that having someone or having support around you that helps kind of fill those needs, it just makes the experience a very positive one.
So you've hit on a couple of things I want to emphasize. Working from what Sarah just described is actually the name of the book that is another classic that influenced me from the anthropological point of view. The woman described Dana Raphael called mm-hmm. Mothering the Mother. And mm-hmm. mothering the mother is the essence of survival of the species. And the reason we forget that it's critical is that we have forgotten that birth often meant life or death, and that without lactation, the baby died. And so the only way cultures could continue was to make sure the mother survived and could lactate. And the only way to do that was to make sure there were taboos and rituals and traditions in place. So if you look at this from the cultural anthropological background that we now have analyzed, you know, it was all just taken for granted. This is what you, Sarah, just described. It's critical. I think it's sad that we have lost touch with that. It should not be something we have to pay for. The professionalism aspect is modern. The idea that cultures around the world that are still, quote unquote, intact, take it for granted that this is what happens, that the woman is birthed only surrounded by women, and that they're assured that they will be fed, and then this is back to incentives with food around certain kinds of food. The understanding of hot and cold in some cultures still prevails, that the woman can't lift a finger and do anything for, you know, 3 months, 1 month, whatever it may be. But these things are ancient, and why we let go of it, we need to, you know, assess and realize we shouldn't have. But we need to accept that it cannot be done alone, and we need to talk about it. That's back to the expectation, and that's back to understanding. One of the calls I got on the warm line through PSI years ago was from a woman who had been born in China, become American citizen, was having her baby in America, but her mother was coming from China to take care of her and them. Mm-hmm. And the new mommy said, but I want to wash my hair, and I'm sick of eating chicken. her mother is coming from the culture in which she gave given birth. That's the ritual of surrounding that. So it's really back to, you know, understanding and having talked about this and not hurting people's feelings, because you really don't want to do it that way. You want to do it this way. And this is my baby and this is the way I'm going to do it. And, you know, stay out of it because I've got to figure this out myself. So it's a very delicate line that you walk as family, unless the families are already so intact and so communicative. And you find that there are many families that have this all figured out and don't understand what we're talking about right now, because it's like not even an issue. And one other thing, Esther, I wanted to bring up, you cannot see depression, and you cannot tell by looking is an expression. It's actually a campaign. You cannot tell, just ask. And even that's not
good. And you and I are testament to that, because no one ever asked me.
No. And I was very good and still can be very, very good at masking it. So my depression still comes and goes. And so I think this is an important thing. This can be acute or it can be chronic, and it just needs to be open and honest. And I frankly, right now, I find one of my best therapies is ice skating. And one of the girlfriends, well, and she said, Jane, you're doing that because it's therapeutic, isn't it? And I go, yes, because it's quiet, it's routine, it's soothing, it's cold, it's everything. It's everything that I need for my body. And so people need to find what it is that's good for them to get away. And I was going to, maybe if we have time, I'd like to take people through what I call steps to wellness, and making sure, making sure that everybody understands that there's, you know, it's so logical here. And I want people to, if you have pencil and paper and you're listening, can write things down. The steps to wellness are common sense. That the first one is sleep. And doesn't matter how old you are or where you come from, are you male, female, big or small, tall?
How many babies you
doesn't
have.
Doesn't matter. If you can't sleep, it's an issue. Okay, so sleep is critical to good health. The second one is appetite and nutrition. Mm-hmm. And if you can't eat well, because you, then this is where depression kicks in or reveals. You ask yourself, what have I eaten? How am I eating? Do I want to eat? Am I eating the right things? This goes to your children. I mean, this is something that we live with forever. So sleeping well and eating well. And the next one is exercising. Because it doesn't mean going to the gym. I mean, have you gotten out of the house today? Have you walked around the block? Have you done more than just climb the walls of your house? You know, and children, I mean, it's the same thing. And kids, we say they're having a meltdown. It's like, well, did they sleep well? When did they nap? Have they eaten well? When did they last have their feed? And have they had a chance to breathe the fresh air? And that's really critical to health. And those three words are very biological. Because if we frame them in the sense of this is how you stay healthy, this is what everybody's told, right? And we forget as new parents how completely and utterly this shifts for multitudes of reasons, all right? But then the other part to exercise is the words time for myself. And this is particular to parenthood. But sometimes it could be for a child, too, who is having a quote-unquote meltdown, and they haven't had their nap, and they need to be left alone. So we also sometimes need to pause and think about that. For the parents, it could be a night out, right? But have I had time to even wash my face this morning kind of time? So it's about putting those three words together and then assessing, well, yeah, I just had a baby. Of course I'm not sleeping. I'm nursing, and of course I have to eat well, because if I don't, the baby, I don't have milk, whatever. You can see how these simple words can change everything and help you assess, how are you doing? And where do I need more help? Do I need more sleep? Does that mean somebody else should be coming in and waking when the baby wakes, let me sleep? You need to work that out. Does it mean that somebody should be bringing me the chicken soup? You need to figure that out. And the other parts of steps to wellness, the ones that come next, are not the biological ones, but the psychological ones, the ones that, you know, getting emotional support. And that's just the question, do I have anybody that I can trust and I can tell how I'm feeling? Am I getting emotional support? And that's the next step in being well. And when you say, I'm having a bad day to your girlfriend or to your husband or to your child, you say, mommy doesn't, you know, mommy's having a bad day is actually very healthy. It's critical to good health. And the response should not be, but you got everything. Why do you need more emotional support? What are you talking about? That's judgment. And then the other piece after emotional support, the hard part there is asking for help. And when you're depressed, and that's another sign of depression, is often when you get to this place, you do not know what you need. You're so needy, but you don't know what to do. And my husband finally, after all these years, realizes I needed a hug. Don't try to fix it. Don't look for the solution. I'm in the moment. Just be there. Just don't leave the room. Sometimes it's as simple as that. But the follow-on to emotional support and how you just phrased that is that practical support. We've mentioned this about the role of the person who comes in, whether it's a family or a doula or whatever we call a person, to mother the mother. But we all need practical help. And as we age, see, I'm in that generation that we need household help because we no longer want to do all the dusting and the cleaning of the toilets. So, you know, that's important all our lives. And then the last word is after you've assessed and looked back at how you're doing with these words of wellness, do you need professional help? And that's referrals. So that's when you need to be able to, with the help of somebody else, and if people are listening and have written this down, that they share this with the person who's closest to them, whether it's their mother or their friend or their spouse or partner, it doesn't matter. But you have to say, you know, now this is so practical. It is common sense. And yet we let go. And then we say, you know, I've neglected seeing my therapist, or I've was told I should get off my medication. I think it's time that I reassess that. So this really helps. And it's very simple. So it's in a book I wrote called I'm Listening. And that book is I'm Listening and the Steps to Wellness are I elaborate.
Brilliant. More.
They're in there. And they're all on my website. You can go to my website and you can go to Amazon.com and you can find all this stuff that I've written all down. Excellent. And it's simple, common sense. But we seem to have lost touch with a lot of that.
We will make sure to include links to all of that on our website as well, which is fourthtrimesterpodcast.com.
Jane, thanks so much for coming today to our podcast. And it was really fun.
Oh, my pleasure. And it was fun for me.
You can find out more about Esther Gallagher on esthergallagher.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast in order to hear more from us. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Fourth Trimester. The theme music on this podcast was created by Sean Trott. Hear more at soundcloud.com/SeanTrott. Special thanks to my true loves, my husband Ben, daughter Penelope, and baby girl Evelyn. Don't forget to share the Fourth Trimester podcast with any new and expecting parents. I'm Sarah Trott. Goodbye for now.
Hello again, Bicycle Man. I know you're doing all that you can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I'll sing a song for you. You got your wheels, you got your gears. You ride around town without any fear. You got your pedals, you got your brakes. You always wear your helmet for safety's sake.
best that she can. I wrote the song, simple and true. I wrote the song, I sing a song for you.